The next case on the court's calendar is State of Minnesota versus Peter Roy Burns. We're ready for argument. Counsel for Mr. Burns can approach the podium. State your name for the record before beginning argument.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Krista Groshek, and I represent the appellant, Peter Burns. As you know from our briefing, we have several issues before the court. I will list them in the order I plan to address them unless the court would like me to do otherwise. First, I would like to address the issue of the court not granting my motion for a judgment of acquittal. Second, I'd address the departure argument. We believe that the court should have given Mr. Burns a departure in this matter. And then lastly, the sufficiency of the evidence. This case was charged out, interestingly. There was two counts relating to two different complaining witnesses, relating to two different time frames, alleging different things. Count one alleges criminal sexual conduct in the second degree. As to complainant AR, she alleged that during the time frame between January 1 of 2005 through June 30th of 2013, that appellant engaged in acts of touching her, that he committed the crime of touching her intimate parts on numerous occasions. Count two alleged criminal sexual conduct in the second degree as an attempt as to RR, AR's sister. The time frame was different, January 1 of 2011 through December 31 of 2013. The state argued, and eventually the jury did convict my client of attempting the act of criminal sexual conduct in the second degree in the following way. When she was getting ready for bed, my client would allegedly come and try to tuck her in and expose himself to her, show his penis, and say, "Would you hold it to see if it's blue underneath?" Nothing more. If you view the evidence in the light most favorable to the state, RR said this happened many times, that she came to her grandfather's house during the time frame in question. RR said this happened the same way every time, that appellant would approach, ask the question, she would look away, say no, and he would say okay and leave. So a matter of moments that this event unfolded over the course of these years.
So, counsel, you outline the issues as being district court erring, abusing its discretion in terms of not granting the judgment of acquittal first, and second, the departure, and then third, the sufficiency of the evidence. But isn't it really the sufficiency of the evidence intimately tied to the judgment of acquittal?
Right.
Because so it sounds like you're getting really into the third issue. And there's different standards of review. You've got the overarching, but then for sufficiency of the evidence, that really seems to be the heart of the argument there, isn't it?
It is, and I pointed this out in my reply brief, and I believe that the standards got somewhat conflated in the state's brief. Yes, it is about sufficiency of the evidence, but what's so important about the court's decision not to grant the judgment of acquittal that we asked for is that this is a de novo review. And so while the
de novo review overall, but when that's the overall, but when you get down into sufficiency of the evidence, that has its own standard of review.
It does.
And I want to talk about that a little bit, because it seems like the parties seem to agree, and I'm going to ask your opposing counsel the same question, but it seems that both parties agree that the direct evidence standard applies.
Yes, I think that's accurate.
But what's one of the key issues that's at issue is intent.
Right, and I'd like to talk about that if the court's ready.
Yeah, and intent is generally proved by circumstantial evidence, right?
Exactly.
And so why would the direct evidence standard be used here? Because direct evidence is if, for example, appellant said, "I want you to touch my penis," and we don't have any direct evidence of that. What we have actually is RR's statement.
Correct. So if I understand the court correctly, are you asking me whether or not the direct evidence standard applies as to the sufficiency argument?
No. What I'm asking is whether the circumstantial evidence standard should apply just to the intent element.
I do agree with the court on that, now that I understand your question better. I agree with you on that. And as I reviewed the transcript, we never at any point conceded that appellant's intent was to have RR touch him. And when I read back through the transcript, it became clear to me that really what we have here, and I looked a lot at my client's testimony, is him making a glib reference in a dirty old man way to, hey, see if they're blue. And you can assume the state's argument about blue balls applies here. That was never something that the state directly proved. They argued that that's what appellant meant. And I would urge this court to adopt that, because what we see is a glib, inappropriate, distasteful comment made with really no intent to have the child actually engage in the touching.
And I'm having a hard time with that argument. So the child's alone in a room at night in bed, and he walks in and asks the child to hold his penis to see if his testicles are blue. That's what the record shows.
Uh-huh. Correct.
And the law says that intent is generally shown circumstantially, and that we presume that people intend the outcome of their actions. If we view those facts in the light most favorable to the state, how does one not conclude that your client acted with sexual intent?
Because unlike the cases where we're not talking about social media, and I'm guessing we'll get there when we talk about Wilkie, when we look at the cases where we got in-person communication and contact, all the other cases that have come before this court, whether it's an attempted crim sex, attempted murder, we have more than just words.
I agree, but that doesn't mean that these facts can't be enough. And if we're applying a circumstantial evidence standard, your client has a heavy burden to present a reasonable hypothesis of innocence that explains his actions in a way where we would say beyond reasonable doubt that that shows he is innocent. So what's his reasonable hypothesis of innocence?
Because that's all he did. Unlike other cases where there was touching of the child in the case.
Well, but that would be different. That would be different because what we have here is charges attempt. And if touching actually occurred, then you would actually have second-degree criminal sexual conduct. What we have here is attempted criminal sexual conduct.
I agree. In one of the other cases, I believe it's the Thompson case, and I'll find it for the court. But there's a case where the defendant sat down by a child, started talking about how much he wanted the child to touch him. I started massaging her thigh. That's Meemkin.
The Meemkin case.
Yep, that's the Meemkin case. So he's actually placing his hand on the child's upper thigh, asking if he could touch her. The child said no and slapped his hand. He told the child not to tell and continued to ask for touching. He asked the child to twirl in her skirt without panties. He asked the mother if he could lick the child's vagina in front of the child. He masturbated in front of the child with a towel, wanting the child to see. He told the mother he wanted to see the child without shorts on. I mean, from all of those things, that's pretty easy to see what his intent was.
Right, but that's a different case. What we need to do here under the circumstantial evidence standard is, first of all, look at what are the circumstances proved, and Judge Larkin outlined those very well. And then the second step, we look at what are the reasonable hypotheses based on that limited set of circumstances proved. And I think you would agree that one reasonable hypothesis is that he acted with intent to commit criminal sexual conduct, i.e. have her touch his penis.
I wouldn't agree with that.
Okay. So you would disagree with that?
I would disagree that's what we can glean from the circumstances without more. I mean,
fair enough.
Right.
But then we look at all reasonable hypotheses, and in that instance, the standard of review there is we give no deference to the jury. That's a de novo review for that part of it,
mm-hmm.
Okay? My question to you then is, in terms of the attempt element, and in particular the intent element, not sexual intent, because sexual is not in the statute, but the intent to commit a crime and making a substantial step, what more steps would have appellant needed to take in order to attempt to commit criminal sexual conduct in the second degree, which would require touching of one's sexual organs?
I think it's more than a person making a glib comment. I think it's more than a person being dirty or saying nasty things. And
well, would you agree with me that if she had touched his penis, that that would have been criminal sexual conduct in second
degree? I have to concede that. If she touched it, that's the complete
And here, all we're looking at is attempt. And so he's, and well, actually one other key fact is it's at night and he's standing over her, according to her testimony, which we have to view that as being true, and he exposes himself. He's naked. He's got a robe on, I believe, but he exposes himself. So his penis is exposed. He's standing over her and basically says, "Will you touch my penis?" So what additional steps, because we're talking about substantial steps, why aren't those enough of the substantial steps to take? All that's needed is for her to take that action. What more would he have had to do to satisfy, from your perspective, that substantial step?
If I can just clarify the evidence, I believe there was no testimony on how close he was to her. He was in front of her. There was also no testimony that she actually really even saw his penis. In her corner house interview, there was testimony that she couldn't even describe it. Okay? She said she looked away.
But he was exposed. He wasn't wearing clothes underneath his robe.
That was her testimony, correct.
Okay, so he is exposed. He's naked. He opens up his robe.
Yep, or she could see it from underneath. That's correct. There was exposure.
And it wasn't like he was across the room, so she would actually have to like get... He was next to her.
Correct.
Okay, what more did he need to do to complete the substantial step in order to satisfy the attempt element?
To move from the fantasizing, to move from the dirty old man, you know, making... I'm going to ask your question.
Okay.
To move from that to actually trying to show that his intent is to actually have her touch it, I would argue that...
But he asked her to touch it.
One time. And she said no, looked away, and that was it.
The testimony is this happened multiple times. It wasn't just
many
one time
different occasions. Yes. The actual times that this happened were moments at a time. And so if we are really going to make a finding that he had the intent to actually have her touch him, I think you would need to have him pushing her, threatening her, cajoling her.
You're talking about circumstances that are not part of the ones that are proved, though.
Correct. And because that's missing in the record, there is not enough for there to be a finding that he had the intent to actually want this touch to occur.
And I agree that in Memkin, there is more that took place. Well, the only difference there in terms of this particular scenario is that he put his hand on her leg.
Oh, and he said a lot of different things
but
to her about what he wanted.
I know, I'm just talking about if you really want to compare apples to apples, that's the closest, I think. I agree with you there, okay? But what more, but that's those particular facts. Looking at these particular facts, it doesn't seem that he needed to do any more. He asked her to touch his penis. What more needed to be done, not the intent element, I'm talking about the substantial step element of the attempt.
I see what you're saying. So talking about the substantial step piece.
Yep.
Judge Smith, in his findings, said that this is a less complicated scenario than some of the other cases like the JDL case, which was the unpublished case about the Waseca bomb and killing plan. So to the extent that this is a simpler setup, I agree with you there. But in order to actually say that this wasn't just preparation, I think he needed to do something more, take more of a step forward. It has to be a substantial step.
Ms. Groshek, you seem to downplay the fact of the multiple times, but is that not an important fact and therefore factor in analyzing the evidence favorable to the verdict? In other words, and I don't expect you to concede, I expect you not to, but would you agree that there would be a distinction if literally there was one sole incident and perhaps time and place might have made a difference too? This is a bedroom. But the fact that it has happened multiple times, is that not at least evidence towards a substantial step?
I would say no, and I'll tell you why. Because it happened over and over again in the same way, and there was no touching, and she's looking away, it didn't appear that she was ever interested or ever going to be in a position to do it. This was something that he expected not to happen. This was something that he was going to, you know, make a glib, gross comment without any expectation that touching was going to occur. Typically speaking, and we know this from the testimony of Dr. Macklin, who testified in this case, pedophiles groom. Pedophiles step up their action. Pedophiles step up the pressure. Pedophiles make threats. Pedophiles do more than just make a comment. They can't stop themselves. And
that's,
while this
that's
was
not a circumstance proof, though, because that doesn't support the jury's verdict.
In answering the question, I think the repeated times goes to show that there wasn't an expectation that there was going to be touch, because there never had been. And so why this time? Why the fourth time, the fifth time? Why would there be any expectation that this would occur? And the tactics were the same.
Counsel, thank you for answering the question. If I just may sum up, and then you can correct me on rebuttal. As I understand your position, the circumstantial evidence standard applies to determine whether or not he acted with intent to have this act occur. The doesn't seem to be any dispute about the circumstances proved. The facts are what the facts are. But under that test, we have to ask first whether the circumstances proved are consistent with a finding of guilt, and next, whether the circumstances proved are inconsistent with a finding of innocence. So your position ultimately is the circumstances proved are not adequate to establish guilt, so we don't even go on to explore a hypothesis of innocence.
Correct.
Thank you.
And if I could...
You can on rebuttal.
All right. I see it.
Thank you.
Flashing. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Assistant Ramsey County Attorney Adam Petrus, and I represent the respondent in this matter, the state of Minnesota. I want to jump right in by responding to a couple things about the standard of review here, as Judge Reyes was questioning before. The only authority that I saw in appellant's brief, either the principal brief or the reply brief, regarding the legal standard that's applicable to the denial of the motion for judgment of acquittal is from this court's 2016 decision in De La Cruz. And at the page number that appellant cites, which is page number 890, that's cited on page 9 to 10 of the reply brief, this court wrote, quote, "We review the denial of a motion for a judgment of acquittal de novo, and a motion for a judgment of acquittal is properly denied where the evidence, viewed in the light most favorable to the state, is sufficient to sustain a conviction." So as the panel was indicating before, it is a de novo review, but we are looking at sufficiency of the evidence here. In terms of whether it's a direct or a circumstantial standard that's applied, obviously the state prefers a direct standard, but I did concede, if you saw on page 14 and 15 of my brief, that when we're talking about intent, whether it be, you know, a non-sex crime or the sexual intent, sexual aggressive intent that's required in a sex crime like this.
And we're talking specific intent here.
Right, and thus the circumstantial evidence standard would be appropriate for addressing that particular element. I do agree for the reasons put in the cases that I cited in my brief. But going to the two-prong test, if we want to talk about specific intent first, the circumstances proved that were discussed before, I think Judge Larkin did a very nice job of laying them out, of appellant exposing his penis to, at the time, his 6 to 8 year old step-granddaughter, Raquel. And after exposing his penis, he asked his step-granddaughter to hold it or to touch it. And then he told his step-granddaughter over the course of this happening that he wanted her to see if his penis or if the area was under it was blue. And as this panel noted before, this happened every time that appellant put his step-granddaughter to bed in the basement of his home. Appellant's claim that he lacked sexual intent completely ignores reality. What other intent could there reasonably be when a person asks his young 6 to 8 year old step-granddaughter to touch his exposed penis?
Well, let's go, let's back up just a little bit. So do you agree with any of the circumstances proved that were discussed with appellant's counsel?
I agree with the three that I just laid out myself, and there's some additional ones if you'd like me to go over the whole realm of circumstances proved in this case.
Yeah, it would have been better to have it obviously in the brief, but I think this is an important issue, and I think we do need to get clarification, or at least what the parties agree to be the circumstances proved.
Well, I guess the reason I did not go through it in my brief is I wasn't responding to a circumstantial evidence argument in the brief, but in addition to the three that Judge Larkin named before, and I think I just repeated, we can look at the pornographic video. And I understand that appellant argues that there were no images or videos of women performing oral sex on men that were ever entered into evidence in this case. That's true. But we had Raquel, the victim in this case.
R.R.?
Yes. Telling the MCRC nurse in her interview, which was substantively admitted to trial, as well as testifying from the witness stand, that appellant showed her these pornographic videos on his iPad numerous times. And then when law enforcement went to confiscated the iPad from appellant's home, that was the one electronic device that they were not able to access its contents of. So we have RR testifying that she was shown these videos, and that is a circumstance proved in support of the verdict.
Can we focus on the circumstances proved in terms of the incidents themselves, though? I think those are more relevant than that, because that seemed to be disputed, and there wasn't any corroboration. But even putting that aside, what are the circumstances proved?
Well, circumstance proved does not need to be corroborated. It just needs to be the evidence in light, in the light most favorable to the verdict. And I think it does go, Your Honor, to the intent piece in terms of him showing or watching these videos in her presence and then going forward with the acts later on. But to get to your question, you pointed out earlier in your questioning that the time of day when this happened, it happened when appellant was tucking in RR for the night. He waited. I don't know the exact distance away he was standing from RR, but he obviously waited until he and RR were alone before he acted. He exposed his penis to her and then asked her to hold it and to touch it. And when she resisted, appellant told RR that her older brothers had also held and touched his penis as a way of explaining that it was okay for her to do so too. And then he also specifically asked her to check his penis or the area below it if it was blue, which is a clear reference to unrelieved sexual arousal. And I think it is obvious in this case that a penis is an intimate part and obviously the sexual organ in the male body. Those are the circumstances proved regarding the repeated acts of asking RR to touch his penis. And I want to point out a distinction between this case and one that was discussed earlier, and that's this court's decision in Meekum. Yes, there was, as Judge Reyes pointed out, that touching on the thigh in that case that was not present under the unique facts that we have here. But in Meekum, the defendant was asking to touch the victim. He was doing the same thing he was asking to do. In this case, we have the defendant asking the victim to touch him, specifically to touch his penis. So that's why it made more sense in Meekum for that additional physical contact to be taking place on the thigh.
So with respect to the second step of the circumstantial evidence, I'm assuming you're going to be arguing that it does lead to the conclusion of guilt. So I think we can assume that, right? I want to focus more on the second. Why isn't there a reasonable alternative hypothesis that these are just glib statements that are made, that it's very common to make those types of statements to a certain generation that, you know, nowadays people view it, well, no, that probably isn't the best.
I guess I'm offended by the suggestion that these are at all acceptable. to be made over and over again to a young granddaughter who's 6 to 8 years old.
Well,
I could not see how that would
be. The question isn't whether it's acceptable. The question is whether or not this goes really to the intent element of whether or not the intent really was there to have sexual contact, or was it the intent was just to try to be funny in a way that certain people certainly would not find humorous at all, but some people might make a statement like that that, in their mind at least, is you know, just trying to be funny, trying to goof around, trying to be silly, whatever it may be.
So I understand your question, Judge. The alternative hypothesis that's being suggested is that this defendant, appellant, was just trying to be funny?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I don't think that's reasonable. I just do not think that is reasonable under the circumstances proved. I think that would be unreasonable given the circumstances that I just went out. Maybe if it happened once. That's another distinction between this case and Wilkie, is because in Wilkie, yes, there were 2 days of social media conversations, but that's because the defendant in that case and the victim, I understand that the victim was a police undercover profile, but they didn't know each other. That's why that 2 days of social media courtship was necessary. The attempt in that case was only going to happen once when the defendant went up and rang the doorbell. What we have here is something that happened every single time that RR went to her grandmother's and appellant's house, to the point that she refused to go there anymore, which is another circumstance proved in the record that she testified she no longer wanted to go there because of what was happening to her when she was tucked in every night.
Mr. Peters, is it not true that the evidence that was proved does support a fifth degree criminal sexual conduct given the age of the victim? The exposure?
And I think it would support those facts, but I think it also supports more than that.
But my point being is, that does that not go into the analysis? In other words, if the court had given a lesser included one option, the jury could have said not guilty in the attempt because of the lack of intent, but would have convicted on the fifth degree. Doesn't that, in and of itself, as part of that analysis, suggest there's a reasonable hypothesis other than guilt of attempt, but there is a completed offense for fifth degree?
I don't think it would have been reasonable for the jury to acquit on these facts, and I don't think it'd be reasonable for this court, even in the de novo review that this court has on the second step of the circumstantial evidence standard review, to find that it was reasonable that appellant was just trying to be glib and funny every single time he asked his step-granddaughter to touch his penis.
Well, counsel, on that point, we have to be clear regarding who has what burden in this case. It is not the state's burden or this court's burden to proffer a reasonable hypothesis of innocence that results in reversal of a conviction. It's the appellant's burden to proffer the reasonable hypothesis of innocence, and I've heard from appellant's counsel that they're not proffering one because they don't think the evidence is sufficient to establish guilt in the first place.
I could not agree more, Judge Larkin. I do want to go back briefly to something, Judge Slater?
Sleater.
I apologize, Your Honor. Going to your question, if you review in the transcript, not of the trial, but of the motion hearing that took place after the trial, it was on August 31st, 2018. It's when Ms. Groshek brought the motion for a judgment of acquittal and argued it. On pages 2 through 5 of that transcript is where Ms. Groshek describes in plain detail that it was her trial strategy to not request that lesser included offense of fifth degree criminal sexual conduct at the time of trial, with the hope that the jury would not try to, as we often use in this line of work, split the baby and convict on that particular count. So that was an outcome that was fully, I guess, considered by the trial strategy that appellant used going into trial. I can't stress enough that the challenge to the sufficiency of the evidence depends on the unique facts in a particular case. And I agree that there is a range of different facts that are exhibited in the cases that are cited in both my brief as well as appellant's brief. But the unique facts that we have here, an explicit request to touch an exposed penis over and over and over again, not of a stranger, but of a granddaughter, that you have a long-term relationship with and are responsible for caring for at the time that this act is happening under either the direct evidence standard or the circumstantial evidence standard. And when we're talking about intent or we're talking about substantial step or we're talking about the allegations of abandonment, the defendant had all, he had the intent, he took substantial steps, and he did not abandon. I'm happy to answer any questions about abandonment if this court has them. Otherwise, I will rely on the argument in the case that I put forth in my brief.
No.
I am also happy to address any questions that this panel has about the sentencing claim, specifically that Judge Smith abused his discretion by imposing the presumptive sentence.
And the request was for a durational departure.
Correct, because it would have been
a probationary offense with a minimum local.
Correct, it would have been a durational departure to a gross misdemeanor disposition. And Judge Smith denied that and imposed the presumptive sentence. I'm happy to answer any questions this panel has about that issue. Seeing none, I would simply ask that you affirm both the appellant's conviction on the attempted criminal sexual conduct in the second degree and the sentence that Judge Smith imposed.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal?
Speaking directly to the court's question about the separate standard of review to challenges to the sufficiency of circumstantial evidence, I refer the court to State v. Anderson. State v. Anderson talks about considering the reasonable references that can be drawn from those circumstances when viewed as a whole. Additionally, to sustain a conviction based on circumstantial evidence, the reasonable inferences that can be drawn from the circumstances proved, as Judge Larkin, you were discussing, must be consistent with the hypothesis that the accused is guilty and inconsistent with any rational hypothesis except that of guilt. So when we go back to what was actually proved here and you look at these circumstances, Judge Reyes, I think you aptly pointed out that people of a certain generation, my client's generation, talked in ways that we don't talk now. They said offensive things. They treated people differently, women, people of color. And it was clear from my client's testimony, and I want to point the court to that, that he was, at the time of trial, a 74, almost 75-year-old man. He would have been in his early 70s, late 60s, when these events took place. My client, if you look to his testimony, and I was able to more clearly see this when I reviewed the transcripts, he made a number of glib, gross statements. During the course of his testimony, he talked about how he called his brother Leo Pissa because his brother Leo peed out the window when he pulled up with a girl in his car and the top was open and it rained urine on them. That was funny to my client. That's at transcript volume 7, page 161. We know that he had those rather distasteful images of women in string bikinis. String up the front and string up the back, string over the breasts. Those were exhibit 6 and 7. He acknowledged that he hung out with his other older friends. A guy named Larry sent them to him. It was 8 to 12 retired guys that sat and had coffee. We know that he joked about, back to his brother Leo, his brother Pissa getting it by a well-known priest, volume 7, page 162. He made other inappropriate references during the course of his testimony, the whirlpool foaming up like a beer when it was shook up. Taking the evidence as a whole, my client's testimony provides this court with the exact circumstantial evidence that gives the arguments I'm making today credence and credibility.
Right, but we can't look at those if we're looking at the circumstantial evidence in terms of intent.
I think that the court should, according to the case law, look at the evidence as a whole.
We do look at the evidence as a whole in terms of what are the circumstances that are proved, though. And case law is very, very clear that it's focused on that limited subset of facts, of circumstances.
And I think without more, this court is not left with the specific intent elements to find that my client had the specific intent to have this child touch him. And again, there is a rational hypothesis. There is a explanation as to why he was doing this. It was inappropriate. It was in reference to his exposure. Again, that's a separate crime. That was not charged. He was not charged with fifth degree. We didn't ask for that instruction.
So what's the reasonable hypothesis of innocence? That he did this just for a joke?
That's correct. That this was part and parcel of who he was. That this was inappropriate. That this went along with his actual crime he committed. Again, not charged, of fifth degree. This was an exposure. And the idea that counsel submits to you that you can only have an exposure case if you don't say anything, I don't think that's rational, and I don't think that's how people act. It would be very odd if a person were to be inappropriate, expose themselves, and say nothing. Could it happen? Sure. But is that the only context in which they're only committing a fifth degree versus an attempted higher-level crim sex? With regard to Wilkie, I would ask this court to look at that as a very narrow holding that's under review right now to the Supreme Court. There's a strong dissent by Chief Justice Cleary. That's a case about social media. I think applying that kind of a case in this day and age where we are developing relationships, people are sexting, and that can happen over social media, it would be totally inappropriate to apply it to an in-person type of a case. And that progeny clearly states that you do need to have something more. There's physical acts, there's other things that are happening to show that substantial step forward, even though this is a more simple set of circumstances. There's got to be more. We have, whether distasteful or not, rights to free speech. We can say gross things. We can be inappropriate, but it doesn't mean that all of that puts us in a spot where we're going to be attempting criminal sexual conduct criminals. And that's my worry and concern. That's why I think this court should find that Judge Smith erred in not granting our request for a judgment of acquittal.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you to the attorneys for your arguments and briefing. The matter is submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days.